Today's guest on the show comes all the way from London in the UK. Please welcome Georgie.
Hi, Steve.
How are you?
Good, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing great. It's a beautiful day out. I'm enjoying another cigar.
Nice.
How is everything over there? How's the weather?
It's pretty good. We had 2 weeks of glorious sunshine. It's a little bit grey today, but we're holding up pretty well, thank you. Not too bad at all.
Now you're in the London area.
That's right.
It's about a 5-hour difference from where I am in North Jersey, so that's a good amount of time. I remember when I was in Europe, I think it was the same.
Yeah.
It wouldn't change, obviously, but depending on the time of year, you know, we have daylight savings time, so sometimes it's like 6-hour difference, I believe.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
I'm getting my fix right now because the Premier League is on and they're showing really good highlights of really, really good games over the past few years, so... You know, I definitely enjoy that brand of football.
That's what we like to hear. Well, I'm from Liverpool originally, so I'm a proper football girl.
I wake up on Saturday mornings and it's, let's see, around 8 or 9. So it's like 1, 2 over there.
Yeah.
And there's always something live. Some live sporting event when you wake up in the morning is every man's dream.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. You know.
So it's tough. It's tough times now then with no live sport.
Yeah. Well, NBC Sports still puts on the older games, you know.
Yeah.
So some really good matchups.
Uh-huh.
And then I'll go on and I'll watch some hockey. There's not much. Baseball's kind of boring, so I don't really care for watching that reruns of baseball games.
Sure.
Especially since my team sucks.
We don't really do baseball over here.
I know.
Yeah,
it's so slow.
We've got cricket, which I think is even more boring than baseball, if that were possible. But cricket is just mind-numbing. Sends you to sleep.
Where do you think baseball comes from, cricket?
Oh, does it? I wasn't sure which way around it went. But baseball has a touch of glamour to us. But cricket just snoozes.
It's just a bigger field. It's a bigger playing surface, and I think there's more showmanship in baseball. You know, running around the bases and stuff like that. And there's definitely the personalities are like any other sport. Except hockey is not very personality driven. That's why I like hockey.
Yeah.
It's like blue collar. You know, you're allowed to punch people in the face. And it's kind of American. Right there, so.
Yeah. No. We do again. Hockey's not a big thing over here either. Actually, it's so kind of football focused, I think. But yeah, there's a lot of people missing their football over here. That's for sure.
You know, part of it, and I know you have a beautiful accent.
Thank you.
Part of watching the Premier League is I get a little bit of my English accent. You know, proper English accent. Fixed,
yeah.
Everyone, I don't know, it's kind of like a hidden, no one really wants to admit it over here, but we kind of love that accent.
Really? Oh. You know?
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, we're pretty far off from revolutionary days where we can actually enjoy an English accent and not feel guilty, but that's why the family is so big in this country.
Wow.
As far as popularity.
Yeah.
And it's died off a little bit lately, but my grandmother, she was born here, you know, she's Irish, and she was... All she wanted to do was like watch stuff about royal family.
The royals, yeah. No, they're big. They're a big export of ours. But you know, nobody in England actually talks like the royal family. I mean, their poshness is beyond anything that any of us can emulate over here. They're so posh.
I know. I'm trying to think about. We have a whole sect of people over here that are very posh, like that.
Yeah.
We call them WASPs.
Yeah. We've got that expression over here as well. Yeah.
Yeah, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm Protestant, and my last name's English, so I guess I kind of fall.
You're kind of a WASP. Bit, yeah. You just have to.
Yeah.
You have to get one of those pastel-colored jumpers. There's a kind of a WASP look, isn't there?
I got the seersuckers.
Okay.
So, and I got the sparrows.
You're nearly there. You're nearly there.
Yeah. All I have to do really is just when I walk outside my house, I just see someone and I say, hey, I point at them, I say, go pick something up. Over there, and they're like, oh, okay, all right, I'll do it.
Oh, I bet that goes down well.
Oh yeah, serves my ego. Now you are very inspirational to me, because when I see you post about, you come on and you say hello, Sober Gang, and you have like this soft voice that goes right into the picture you're setting right there with the whole nature.
Oh, thank you.
And you know, if you see on my page, it's all about nature and like getting out and trying to live that life and be one with the world around you. Mm-hmm. And it's so refreshing to see somebody else do that. Mm-hmm. And it's so relaxing. You know, I watch like painting shows. I've never painted. I have no desire, but I'll watch like Bob Ross painting about mountains.
Uh-huh.
And it's just like, it just goes with that. And when I'm out, you know, I'm out by myself or just me and my dog, I just like breathe in, take in everything, because that's that part that I missed when I was drinking.
Absolutely.
And drugging, because I never was awake really during the day. And if I was, I was miserable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So now you grew up in Liverpool.
That's right. Yeah.
Let's get into your background. What was it like for you growing up?
Okay, so, so I grew up in Liverpool, as you said, and I'm the youngest of six kids. So we're kind of a typical old school kind of Irish descendant Catholic family.
Irish Catholic.
That's right.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you can tell by the number of kids. We like the big families. So, and even in my day, that was already kind of unusual to have a family that big. And we also lived with our grandparents. So as a household, we were a household of 10. And it's really funny just thinking back to my childhood to talk to you today. Because at the time, obviously everyone thinks they're normal, don't they, when you're growing up, of course, because it's all you know. But we were a kind of, we stuck out like a sore thumb, really. So it was a house full of 10. And because of that, we kind of lived in a bigger house than most of my kind of school friends would live in a sort of a nicer part of town. But our house was dilapidated. We didn't have a lot of money at all. And we were kind of a household of 10 living in a household of, you know, most people would have like four people living in a house. So we,
yeah, correct.
Exactly. We were nothing worked. Everything was broken. We all shared rooms. We didn't have a lot of money at all, but you know, we never ever went without. My mum and dad were really good people. They both worked really hard to make sure we never went without. But we didn't, you know, we all wore hand-me-down clothes. We certainly didn't have the latest gear. We didn't have any gear that didn't look like something out of an Ina Blyton novel. I remember thinking back to my primary school years, and I had a happy childhood in that it was a happy, busy home. But I didn't really have a happy sort of early school days. I was sort of thinking back, I was quite bullied at school. I was the fat kid as well, which is always tough. Like, you grow up and forget that, but that's kind of the center of your world, is how you're viewed by your peers at that age. So it was tough. Primary school was not a great time for me. I was kind of fat. I didn't really have the right friends. I certainly wasn't wearing the right clothes. And I kind of came from this weird oversized family that lived in a strange part of town. So yeah, childhood was a mixed bag for me. But as I say, like, really loving parents. They were much older than other kids' parents as well, because I was the youngest of six. So my mum especially was very kind of Victorian in her, quite strict, very uncommunicative. We didn't talk about stuff. You know, if there's a problem, you kind of got on with it. Not in any way unkind, but just very stern. My dad was the exact opposite. He was really gregarious and warm and funny, and he was kind of the centre of my world really as a kid. So, you know, it was a happy childhood. It wasn't in any way unhappy. But I realised, I think, when it was time to sort of go to secondary school, which is what we call it here, i.e. when you sort of, you know, you're age 12, you go up to, well, I'm not sure what you call it in the States, is it?
Middle school,
yeah.
Yeah.
And I kind of made, I do remember making this conscious decision thinking, I have to go into secondary school, as we say, as a different person to who I was in primary school, because I'm bottom of the totem pole everywhere. Obviously, youngest of six, you're bottom of the totem pole in the house. I was desperate for kind of attention and approval. And I think I was quite lonely, really, as a kid, because I had a great relationship with my dad. But I didn't really have like a group of friends. I was kind of a bit of a misfit. So I do remember making this conscious decision that shit's going to change when I go into secondary school. I was still like a little chubby checker. So I was still the fat kid. I couldn't really change. Well, I could have changed that, but at that stage, I hadn't found the strength to change that. And so I remember going into secondary school and being like, right, I'm going to reinvent myself. And this is like age 12. And I really did. I kind of changed my voice to make it a little bit less kind of Ina Blyton novel and a little bit more kind of Liverpool Scouse, like the school, you know, the cool kids spoke. And I remember I used to have like a bag of clothes I used to hide. I had a Saturday job by then. We all started working when we were about 12. And I kind of hid this bag of clothes with a few kind of like brand names in that I would just hide in my school bag and then change on the way to school. So I was kind of already living a slightly double life. And I can't, somehow I managed to muscle my way into like the cool kids group. I wasn't really one of the popular girls. I was on the outskirts, but I managed to rebrand myself. And I do remember doing that at kind of, you know, the age of 12. And so, yeah, stuff was going well then. And it was a happy childhood. It was a happy home, but there wasn't a lot of time or attention or money or any of those kind of things. But that didn't matter. I was doing okay. And by the time I got to secondary school, I think I kind of started to find a tribe a little bit, which I've noticed really is a theme in my life, is trying to find a tribe. I think we all need that, don't we? But looking back to those years, it was so important. And I think that's what I didn't have as a younger kid. So I'm at secondary school now. Things are going okay. And I think this is when the big first bombshell started dropping in my childhood, which kind of, looking back on it, had huge impacts on me. And the first kind of started with the natural progression of life. So when I was sort of 12, I lost my granddad. When I was 13, I lost my nana, which is completely normal for a kid, but they lived with us all our lives. So the relationship with them was so much stronger than it would be had they, you know, lived out of town and we visited them once a, you know, public holidays or whatever.
So you saw them every day, basically.
Every day. And also I was really close with them. I had this sort of, I felt like they were kind of in my corner a little bit more. I don't know. When you live in a massive household like that, you do kind of, you break off into factions a little bit. Also, their room was the only warm room in the entire house because we never had the central heating on, ever. But there was always a little bar fire in their room. And it sounds a bit Charlie in the Chocolate Factory, but we would literally cuddle around this little bar fire. And I spent a lot of time with them. And they smoked like chimneys. They were proper like old school working class, like Scousers. So their deaths did have an impact on me. It was one immediately after the other, really. And then at the same time as all that sort of going on, my elder brothers and sisters were all leaving the house like one year after the other, because when you got to 18, you went to university or college, as you say. And so that was a changing dynamic as well. So every year, really, one of them would just go, because at that time in the UK, it was, you got your education for free and they paid your accommodation as well. It's not like that anymore. But that's how it worked back then. But the big bombshell in my childhood came when I was 14, when my dad was diagnosed with cancer. And that was obviously awful. But it was heartbreaking. But I think what made it so much worse with hindsight is that we never discussed it. I sort of have this memory of my mum telling me that she told me in a really weird way, like something like she had abnormal cells, which meant nothing to like a 14-year-old. And I was like, well, okay. We never discussed the fact that it was terminal. We never discussed the fact that this is what's going to happen. We never talked about our emotions. It just wasn't that kind of household. Coupled with that, my brothers and sisters kind of leaving one at a time. So we kind of gone from this like house of 10 to, I think at that stage, it was like me, my mum, my dad, my sister, my brother who's just about to leave. And basically that I've kind of pinpointed was the turning point for everything in terms of me going off the rails, because totally understandably there I just went off the ball completely as far as I was concerned, and you know, with very good reason. And at that age I just started to really go off the rails. So it coupled with that time in the UK where the rave culture was really starting to build. So it's like the 90s rave scene, and there was these like huge...
I remember that well.
Yes. Was that part of your thing as well?
In Manhattan.
Oh my God. Yeah, so we were probably at it at the same time. But in Liverpool, there was like these huge kind of disused warehouses, and there'd be these massive sort of acid house raves going on. And I was just rocking up to this stuff as like a 14-year-old. I started to hang around with this gang. They weren't a bad gang, you know, they weren't bad people, but they were taking drugs and they were going to these like huge raves, and I was kind of on the outskirts of that, and I just kind of got sucked into it really. And I'd just be gone for whole weekends at the age of 14, with no accountability. I'd say like I was going to stay at a girlfriend's, and like I was, but I was also going getting mashed up in these like huge raves and at a really young age, but having a good time really. And to me, strangely, I was thinking, I felt a real kind of sense of belonging in that community. It was nothing to do with what you looked like. It was nothing to do with, you know, it was a real counterculture. But obviously it was totally drug centric. And so I was very young really to like kind of fall into that world. So I guess that was my first experience of just like euphoric artificial highs. And as I say, it was at a really young age. And at the same time, all of these kind of things were unfolding at home, which were terrible. And I think, I'm trying to remember, I guess I was about 16 and we were on one of the, you know, I was still totally functioning. I was still going to school. I was doing badly at school, really badly, but still going. I was getting away with it. Nobody really had their eye on the ball to sort of say, well, where do you go every weekend? But it gradually, about 16, sort of, it was very clear that my dad was so ill, but still there was no dialogue. And by that stage, it was just me, my mum, and my dad left in the house because my elder brothers and sisters had all gone to university then. And I remember he was at one of his many hospital visits, and I remember just, I think I asked a doctor because I didn't really have that dialogue with my own mum, and I think I said to a doctor, is he going to die? And they just looked at me and were like, well, yeah, like, of, you know, of course. And I do remember it strike, although I'd known for a while that he had cancer, it all hit me at the same time that this was it, you know, he wasn't going to pull through.
So, and your mom didn't talk to you about what the future might hold with your father?
No, never, never.
And your father was the one that was empathetic, and then your father was the one, is that correct, that used to open up and let you share your thoughts and converse with you, right?
Well, it's funny, none of us spoke about our emotions or feelings or what the future would hold. My dad was a really warm, funny, gregarious, sort of happy-go-lucky person, but he didn't open up about his emotions either. And my mum was just really kind of Victorian English, you know? She was a really good person, but she didn't talk about emotions in any way. And she was a great mum in so many ways, like she gave us everything we needed, but emotional dialogue did not exist at all. I don't think she knew how to do it because of her own upbringing. It's hard to dig into really, because I wouldn't want to say anything disparaging about her because she's a product of her own upbringing herself. Right. Yeah. But I just kind of realized at that point, okay, this is it. And thank God, like something in me at that moment was like, everything has to stop now and you have to be part of this process. So but at that stage, it was me, my mum, my dad in the house. My dad was obviously dying. We were going to look after him at home. And so for a year of my life, it just totally was on lockdown. And we nursed my dad. And so all of the raving stopped, all of the, you know, all of that was on hold. And yeah, it was a really difficult it was hard to think back to that time really, because it was so long ago now, but I was 17 at the time. He died when I was 18, just turned. And it was just a really terrible year, obviously. And when he died, it was just like this huge light had gone out. Like anyone who loses a parent, whatever age, it's just an enormous impact. But for me, he was kind of like the center of happiness. He was just such a positive force. So that was huge and tragic. And that my mum then went into a sort of spiraled into a depression. And then it was just me and my mum. And I was quite young to really understand how to handle that, because I was obviously trying to deal with my own grief, but trying to help her through it. But there was no, you know, this is so long ago that there was no kind of counselling or grief counselling. There was no tools in the box. We were just kind of floating around in this void, really, thinking like, God, what the fuck do we do now? And my brothers and sisters, great though they were, all had to go back to their various lives. Like some of them were living abroad by then. So it was a tough year. And during that year with my mum, the nice part of that was we bonded in a way that we were never close, me and my mum. We were so different. She was totally, we're like chalk and cheese. And during that year, we really kind of did bond in a way that is still with us today, given how different we are. So there was, you know, there were those positives come out of it. But I think it was that year really where, after this kind of slightly drug-addled past, that I found alcohol after drugs, really. And I think it was during that year with my mum that I was drinking with her. She was never a drinker at all, like not a big drinker, but, you know, it was in the house. And I would sort of start drinking wine with her. Then I'd go out with local friends and drink wine. And it kind of started building up then, I guess. And after a year at home with my mum, I realised that I had to get out of Liverpool, because by that stage, it was just like kind of obviously me and my mum in this house. And I didn't want to leave her. I had this enormous guilt, but I knew I just had to get out. I had to go to university. And God knows how I did it, but I managed to get the grades just enough to kind of scrape into a university down south. Just outside of London. So that's what I did. And then a year later, when I was 19, I came to university. And obviously what I didn't realise at the time was I was just totally fucked up in the head. But you have no cognitive sort of appreciation of that at the time. I was grieving, I was kind of broken inside. I had this very sort of strange past where by the time I'd even gone to university, I'd already kind of lived a bit of a wild life that nobody really knew about. And there I was, and I was kind of at uni with all of this baggage that wasn't being addressed. And I think this was my second big reinvention, because by the time I got to university, I was like, right, okay, I wasn't the fat kid anymore. All those years of raving had kind of like slimmed me right off. It shouldn't matter, but it does matter, like how you're accepted into the next tribe. Mm-hmm. And I guess at uni, I found my tribe really quickly, because it was
you're
just
leveling
like...
up, basically. You're leveling up into a new area of life.
Exactly. And I guess I felt like I'd lived so much life, like kind of watching someone, losing someone and nursing them through that illness. And I kind of had this kind of hedonistic button, because I'd been living in this cave really for a year with my mum, and I kind of hit this button so hard when I got to uni, and it was just non-stop, like really non-stop, which is kind of normal because that's what people do at uni. But I was the party girl. That was kind of my only kind of identifying point, was if there was a party, I'd be at it. And it was a great, and I, do you know what, I met some of my best friends now, the friends I met at uni. That was where I really found my tribe, who I felt like I just had this real identity with and status with. You know, I wasn't bottom of the totem pole anymore. I kind of had this real energy, and I really liked it, you know. I really liked that status, and I felt like all of those kind of euphoric highs, and it felt like everything, every part of who I was invested in that party girl image, and that was all centered around being off your face in one way or another. So that kind of, I think, became really embedded in me that this is what I am, this is what I do, I'm a party girl. There didn't really seem to be any negative consequences at that stage. I didn't realize I was running away from anything. I was just loving it, you know, I was just really loving it. And the clubbing continued and the drinking continued and there was drugs. But I was somehow, looking back, God knows how I managed to limp through the academic side of it, but somehow I did, and I don't know how, but I did. And we were kind of getting to the end of uni, and you know, my friends, I did know that I was much more extreme than anyone else I know. I always knew that I had this inability to find an off button. I never wanted the party to end. I was quite good at making the party continue for as long as like humanly possible. And so I guess as it started to come towards the end of uni, I was thinking, shit, like, how am I going to slot into the world? Because I have no skills other than just keeping parties going.
This is like, rough.
Yeah, it was feeling, and I remember seeing this sense of panic, thinking like, shit.
Impending doom.
Yeah, what am I going to do? Like, literally, I could see us being pushed to the exit and thinking, fuck, I've got to find something to do. And I remember being on this night out in this, there's this big club called the Ministry of Sound in London. And we used to go there all the time. And you'd make friends pretty easily in places like that. And I remember chatting to this girl, and she was air stewardess, and she worked for a very famous British airline, won't mention any names. And she was saying, man, it's this great life. You just fly down, you know, you fly somewhere, you do your flight, you spend a week there. We just party all the time. And I remember thinking, oh my God, this is it. This is what I can do. I can be an air stewardess. That sounds great. I can like pour tea and coffee, and you know. So I just remember having this like light bulb moment. I mean, it, you know, in my dream world, I would have gone traveling like a lot of my friends did, but I had zero cash, no access to cash, obviously. So I thought, this is it. I'm going to do it, and so I did. And so I left uni and I went straight into a job with this British airline. And oh my God, she was absolutely right, because it was just a party. And like, bear in mind, this is like 25 years ago, something like this, a long time ago. So I'm sure it's not how it works anymore. But back then, I was on a very young fleet. We flew out of London. A lot of people were just kind of like me. They were just doing this as a kind of a stopgap job. Massive kind of party atmosphere, and that's what we did. And all of the alcohol on board the plane was totally free of charge to the passengers. Yeah, totally free of charge. I think it's quite different in the States, because I think you have so many more internal flights that flying is more of a kind of a, you know, a normal event, whereas the flights that we were doing were kind of, there was a lot of scheduled flights, but there was a lot of kind of business travelers, but holiday flights as well. And it was totally free. It was unlimited. It was free and it was unmonitored. So people would just get on and you'd serve their drinks all the way through the flights. And at the end of the flight, you just bundle bags of drinks back to the hotel with the cabin crew, and the party would get started. And thinking back on it, my God, it's so dodgy now. But we used to do landing drinks. We used to do, which is drinks that you'd have as soon as the plane landed. They'd have them all ready for all of the crew. And then you'd do like bus juice, which were the drinks that you drank on the bus going to the hotel. then you'd be drinking in the hotel, then you'd go out, and there were some nights when you take a flight back and you wouldn't even sleep, you just stay up and party all night and then do the flight back in the morning. The captain wasn't doing that, by the way, but the cabin crew were. But it was just next level. And for me at that age, I thought, geez, this is like Nirvana, this is great. And I loved it. It was just great. You smile at people, serve them drinks, have a bit of bants, go and spend like 4 days in Naples, and then next flight you'd fly with a different group of people every time, and it was just this constant social party, you know. It felt great. And also back in those days, my God, there weren't hangovers. It just felt like this free pass to everything. And my God, did I like take it the bull by both horns. Obviously now, like, there were so many red flags. Like, for instance, sometimes you'd be working in different time zones and I'd get back and it would be like 6 o'clock in the morning here, but it would have been like, you know, 10 o'clock at night wherever I was. So I'd be like, I can just have like a cognac. You know, I had a constant free stream of alcohol to help me get to sleep. And I didn't really think there's anything that normal with it, because I was always kind of operating on a slightly different time zone anyway, and it was so normalized around me. So that was obviously I was living the high life, pardon the pun. But yeah, so that I did that for 2 years. And again, I don't know, something by that stage, my friends were getting proper jobs in London. And I was kind of thinking, shit, I can't do this forever. I felt there was nowhere to go. You know, there was no progression. Even I was kind of getting a bit jaded then by the hours that you were keeping, and, you know, you get up at 1 a.m. or whatever it was. And so my next kind of move was to look into getting a job in London. But obviously I had the same problem. Like, I've got no skills. Like, what do I do? I can't walk into a recruitment consultancy and say, look, I'm really good at getting shit-faced, dancing on tables. Really, and, you know, yeah, I can party with the best of them. Well, that, you know what? That did cross my mind, actually. But lucky me. I can't remember how it came about, but I saw a job in advertising, and I thought, oh my God, advertising, that seems really kind of glossy and superficial. I bet that involves a lot of drinking. And I never said it out loud, but my inner dialogue was always how, you know, it was just always party, party, party. And at no stage was I thinking, like, why am I doing this? What am I running away from? Is there, you know, there was never a moment of that. I was just on this kind of like really high octane level of living where I didn't want to scratch beneath the surface, because obviously I didn't know what I was going to find. So I left cabin crew and I got a job in London, and I started living in a house with some of the girls that I went to uni with. So this is kind of my tribe. Still to this day, they're great friends. And they're all party girls as well. But I obviously was taking it to a whole different level. And I kind of knew that, but at the same time didn't want to admit it.
Did anyone say anything, like your friends, did they ever look at you? Because I had that moment when my friend looked at me and said,
yeah,
you got a serious issue. I'm like, we're doing drugs together and you're telling me this? Yeah.
Mate, that is, you see, not really. Yes, once maybe, but not really. I was also quite good at spreading my alcoholism between the different groups of people in my life. So there was actually, my best friend did have a sit down moment with me once, which did have an impact on me. That was some years later. But the way, because people who drink a lot or are hiding any kind of addiction are incredibly good at covering their tracks,
okay,
right?
We are.
I mean, we should all be working for bloody MI5, because we become quite devious and quite clever in how we organize our lives, don't we? We kind of, you know, for me, I would be drinking. I mean, the whole reason I remember the interview for the job, in my first job in advertising, the third interview was they wanted to take me out drinking to see how I could handle drinking. And that for me was like, Jesus Christ, I'm actually being interviewed to see how good I am at drinking. This is all my Christmas has come at once. So I thought back then, because so much of that job was based in like bars and lunches and, you know, advertising agencies. And it was so 80s, really. It was like really behind the time, because even for that era, it was... It had that real kind of like, look at which bar I'm in, look at which jacket I'm wearing, look at what, you know, it was very kind of old school. But obviously I loved it at the time.
Well, status. Just it sounds like it was like status.
Totally. It was just all bullshit, vacuous, materialistic. It was all style, no substance. And it was a really toxic world, really, but fucking hell, I lived in it for a long time and I loved it when I was in it. I didn't love it when I was in it. I thought I loved it when I was in it because it was just kind of feeding what I thought I wanted, which was just alcohol. So there were days when I'd go into work and everyone was the same there. All they cared about was money. And as long as I hit my financial targets, which weren't that difficult to do because advertising agencies just had a lot of money that they needed to spend. And if you took them out from the lunches, and they would just spend it on your products. So to all intents and purposes, I was doing great. I was making good money. I bought my own flat. I had sort of relationships, but nothing ever too major. I kind of loved the life too much, really. I was so kind of like, why would I change? I had my own flat in London. I had this great kind of party lifestyle where I'd go into work and I'd have my first lunch at like at 1 o'clock. So I'd be going to a restaurant at one and start drinking. I was getting paid to do this. And as the years went by, I would get to the restaurant half an hour before because I just felt a little bit shaky from the next day. So I'd need to have a drink before the lunch began, before the client arrived. And obviously that's a fucking huge red flag, but it was kind of normalized by the circles that I was running in because everyone just seemed to be these kind of weird versions of kind of functioning alcoholics, really. But I never really identified it. And then my friends that I would kind of hang out with, who all worked in London as well, I would go out with them after drinking in the afternoon at work, you know, and just kind of, it was so difficult to see this is a terrible way to live. Like it became so normalized. But I guess so towards the end of my time in London, my friends started getting married, they started settling down. I was kind of still living this really hedonistic lifestyle. I say that, but you know, I was holding down a job, I was making good money, I had a flat, I used to exercise like crazy because I felt like that balanced things out in my weird twisted sense of logic. But things did start grinding to a halt, and I would spend like holidays and stuff with my sister, who was married and had 3 kids, and she had this lovely family, and I was kind of like this old soak aunt who kind of floated in on a cloud of champagne and, you know, presents from London every now and again.
Did you have a big fur coat too when you did it?
I did fake fur, Steve, but I mean, I looked like something. Do you ever watch Absolutely Fabulous? I don't know whether you get that series in the States.
My mother loves English television, so yeah, I've seen it.
Oh my God. Well, I was basically just turning into the character of Patsy out of Absolutely Fabulous. So yeah, I had the coats, fake fur, but it was just a very sort of shallow and materialistic. And I didn't really have any other element to my life other than, look how great I'm doing. I've got a flat in London. I've got a great job. I'm making money. I've got all these friends. I mean, luckily for me, I did have my real friends from uni. Who, as I say, is still friends with me now. But there was a lot of very fake people in my life around that time that would, you know, make me feel like, yeah, it's fine. Do another, you know, have another drink, do another line. It's fine. This is what everyone does. This is what we do in media. So that was a shitty way to live, really. And I do remember, like, I go to my sister's house for, like, public holidays, and she just had this beautiful family and her kids who were kind of all grown up now, well, teenagers, and they're just gorgeous children today. And I do remember having this moment of thinking, that's your only like really authentic moment is when you're with these people in this house, you know, that I remember kind of getting this glimpse of family life and thinking, you know, this is what you should be doing. This is like where your life should be going. Not that everyone should have children, but you just need to have authentic, you know, relationships. And
you start to feel anyway, like you're missing out of that part of life because all your friends are phony. And I know exactly what you mean because I don't talk to, except for the friends that I went to school with, obviously, I don't talk to anyone.
Yeah. It's so interesting, isn't it? That's such a the litmus test, isn't it? Is I think the people that stay in your life after sobriety, it that's the answer you need to everything, really, isn't it? You know, you know who your friends are when you stop being that person. And yeah, I mean, unfortunately, it took me such a long time to work that out. So the next thing. Huge thing that happened was I met my now husband, and he also worked in media. He worked for an American film company actually, and obviously great that I met someone that I finally connected with. And you know, he drank but nothing like me, and he couldn't believe the culture of the company that I was working for. And he was just like, fucking hell, he's like, I can't believe how hard you lot go at it. He wasn't judgmental, he wasn't kind of like you know, it wasn't like a reprimand, but he just kind of gently pointed out that this was not normal, you know. And and that was kind of great because life just became, I backed off that world so much then. Our relationship became more serious, and life just became much more balanced. I was still drinking, but nothing like how I was. You know, I was kind of lucky like that. I could not turn it off completely, but life just became a bit more gentle. And then, to cut a long story short, we got married. And I mean, it's very Catholic story. We got married in January, had our first child in October. Just worked out like that.
Yeah.
So it's real quick, and then life just like, well, exactly. We were getting on, you know. We married late in life, and you know, life just then changed just beyond anything, and it was amazing. You know, I had this baby that I suddenly realized quite late in life that I always wanted. Had this great husband. It was just great. And it was blissful. I was just in this happy, wholesome baby bubble. I was on maternity leave from work. So I was away from that toxic kind of atmosphere. And I just started to feel just a real happiness, you know, like I'd never really felt before, like a real kind of contentment and a proper sense of belonging. And it just all felt great. And then I got pregnant again while my baby was 5 months old. And then shit got hard because then obviously I'm pregnant and I'm looking after a 5 month old baby. And I'm also then coming under quite a lot of pressure to go back to work. And I'm just thinking, Jesus Christ, I can't go back into that world pregnant and with a baby. But obviously financially, and you know, I was in this real dilemma at that time. And the second pregnancy was so difficult because my husband was then also made redundant from his job. I was obviously then under more pressure to go back to work, but didn't want to, nor did he want me to go back into that environment. It was a very difficult time, but we got through it. I didn't go back to work. I ended up getting some sort of freelance work to keep out of that sort of place. Our second son was born, and then I had kind of two babies, you know. and it was hardcore. It was some hardcore baby rearing, but again, we're doing it. And to cut a long story short, I ended up having three babies in 4 years. And it was a tough time. It was like a wind tunnel of baby rearing, nurturing. And if I wasn't pregnant, I was breastfeeding. And so alcohol, nothing really featured during those years, which was great, but they were tough years nonetheless. Cause you know, my husband got another job. He's working very long hours. I was kind of working from home, had three kids preschool. It was intense. We also moved out of kind of central London and to the suburbs, where I was kind of a lot more isolated, didn't really know anyone. And I think after those kind of 4 years of just hardcore baby toddler rearing, during that time, the next big bombshell dropped in my life, which was when my third son, so I had three boys, was just a few months old. My middle son was diagnosed with cerebral palsy, which is, yeah, no, thank you. I mean, it was an absolutely horrendous time. I'd sort of stopped, I mean, my son is, headline is, he's 8 years old now and he's fucking amazing. Like, he is great. But at the time, I'd noticed that he wasn't hitting milestones. He was the happiest, smiliest, most interactive baby you could ever imagine. But I just noticed he didn't crawl when he was supposed to crawl. It took a long time to sit up. There was a lot of things that were, at the time, I wasn't freaking out at the time because he seemed so engaged and happy. It was just these kind of physical milestones that he wasn't meeting. Yeah. And anyway, subsequently, he was diagnosed really late in life because he couldn't walk, obviously. Well, he has a form of cerebral palsy called diplegia, which is this enormous weakness in his legs. And when they diagnosed him, they told me he would never walk. And I remember holding like my two-month-old baby in my arms when they told me this and just being like, what the fuck? It just came out of nowhere, like literally out of the fucking blue in a GP's office, just saying he was never going to walk. And I just remember being like, fuck. It was like, I just couldn't process it. And also I didn't believe it. My whole initial reaction was like, fuck you. There's no fucking way, that's why. And I didn't believe it because he made such great progress. Like, I knew that he was late on his milestone, so we worked really hard at trying to bring, you know, help him do those things, like whether it's standing up or, you know, whatever it was. And so then my entire life after that diagnosis became focused on how we could help him to progress through this diagnosis. And that, I think, took me then into this kind of second wind tunnel of, I was still very postnatal because obviously I had a very young baby, and I think that brought on a postnatal depression. I was convinced there was something wrong with my youngest son at the stage.
Coming down in your head at once.
There's a lot coming in at the same time at this point. And they're all obviously still very young. My husband's working very long hours. And I do remember going into the GP and saying, like, there's something wrong with my youngest. But my baby, he was like, whatever, 4 months. And I was so hysterical. And I just remember the doctor saying to me, like, there's nothing. I was like, but there's something wrong with him. I'm sure there is. Because by that stage, I was convinced that there was something genetic, or there was something, you know, it was just, which of course it is. It wasn't genetic at all. It was birth related. But anyway, to cut a long story short, I remember the doctor saying to me, like, there's nothing wrong with your baby, but I think there's something wrong with you. You know, you're having like a mental breakdown of exactly. So that was kind of in the midst of you know, when I was really in that wind tunnel. And I think she put me on a very low level of kind of anti-anxiety, antidepressants then, which really helped. And, you know, God, I just really recommend to anyone who feels like they need that, always reach out.
Huge advocate for mental health awareness, and you got to get your mind straight. And if you need to take something,
absolutely. And do you know what? You're so right. And she explained, because I was so, I don't know why I had this stupid, I'm not taking them. I don't know why I got that stupid notion in my head. But she said to me, she just said, look, if you've got a bacterial infection in your throat, I'll give you some antibiotics. It will go away. She said, it's exactly the same. You have an imbalance in your brain at the moment and you need to take. And anyway, that did really help. And, you know, we kind of worked through that. And obviously there was nothing amiss with my youngest son. And my middle son just went on to make amazing progress. He's 8 years old now. He does walk. He runs. He jumps. He does everything that every other kid does. He doesn't, you know, he's amazing. I mean, he really is amazing. Smart as a cookie. He's, you know, he doesn't have a perfect walk. It is a disability. But in the scheme of where we could have been to where we are now is just, I would take this every day of the week, you know. So yeah, that is a huge part of my daily life, because we do physio with him every day. That it's not without its challenges, but we just feel so fucking lucky that the outcome was so positive. But back to how addiction crept back in, really, to my life, was when those kind of baby years and diagnosis years were through. I mean, not through, because you're always living them, but when my life was no longer about either being pregnant or breastfeeding, it started creeping back in, you know, but in a completely different way this time, because obviously I'm not a party girl anymore. I'm not going out. I'm not dressing like Patsy out of Absolutely Fabulous. I'm in sweatpants, covered in crusted vomit, and living in the suburbs. So life has changed.
Responsibilities are way higher and more.
Exactly. Yeah. And it was, but I guess, you know what, Steve, it was such a sudden change from who I was to who I became, like a really sudden change. And also I felt so isolated, really, because we'd moved to a new place, didn't really know anyone. I met the kind of the mums, but I felt that world was quite hard for me to break into, the kind of the mums groups and the mums world. And because I'm a mum and I love my kids, but I don't bake. I don't like talking about my kids. I just like being with my kids when I'm with them. But for fuck's sake, when I'm away from them, please can I talk about something else? Because I spent my fucking life with my kids. And I found myself in this world where everyone was talking about their kids. It's all about the kids. And it's all, and I was like, come on, can't we just talk about Netflix, anything? So I didn't really fit into that world in the way that I felt. So I kind of felt a bit displaced again. And also, you have so little time anyway with three kids who were that young. And also, I was working from home as well. So I had that. So I started a new job by then. And that was just kind of more like straightforward advertising. But it was still an added pressure. And I just found that I started having, straight after bedtime, I'd be like, Jesus Christ, give me a glass of wine. Oh my God, they're finally asleep. Wine. And that wine started creeping forward a little bit more to, oh, they've had their bath, right? They're in their pajamas, glass of wine, to, oh my God, I've got to do their bath. That is so stressful. Oh, just have a glass of wine. That'll, and it was so gradual, this kind of little creepy, creepy, creepy sort of wine before. And you know what? At the same time, this kind of mum culture about wine is so prevalent and powerful. It didn't feel like I was doing anything bad. Everyone's doing it. You know, like all of the kind of memes about mums drinking wine, and that's just what we do. We drink wine. So it started creeping back into my life. I hardly ever went out, but when I did go out on rare occasions, I'd get absolutely shit-faced and I would have like two-day hangovers. Just awful, you know, like the older you get, the less able your body is to process that poison, because you know that's what it is. And it just started getting bad the last few years, and I started realizing that it was the center of everything. Like I started kind of really working out that Jesus Christ, my inner monologue is always thinking about the next drink. I wasn't drinking in the mornings. I wasn't like hiding a bottle in the car. I was never drunk driving. I was always just about on the right side of it. But my mind was becoming a really dark place of, okay, oh, we're going for a walk in the park. Okay, we're going to stop for lunch. Okay, well, it has to be a place that serves alcohol. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, I wasn't going to have a bloody cup of tea and a sandwich. We're going somewhere with a bar. And I noticed that was happening with everything. And the more I was drinking and the more joy it was taking away from me. And this change happened where the alcohol was not about joy anymore. It was just about anesthetic. And I didn't need, it wasn't like, oh my God, I've got to get this high buzz. Because I think the buzz had gone a long time ago. Now it's just like, I just need to not feel shaky, awful, anxious, scared, worried. And I connected alcohol as the answer to all those things. Oh, you're stressed out, have a drink of wine. Oh, you're worried, have a glass of wine. Oh, and towards the end of my drinking days, the wine was turning into gin. So I'd have like, oh, I'll just have a couple of gin and tonics and then a bottle of wine and then some. And it was really scary how quickly it was, my tolerance was building and my intake was rising really quickly. And it was at that stage that I was like, fucking hell. When you're Googling, am I an alcoholic? you've got a fucking problem. And I think we all do that. Yeah. I think that's like your first stage, isn't it? Like we all have to.
How many drinks is too many? And
so exactly. And as soon as you're doing that, you've got a problem, because if you're
second guessing yourself,
cognitive process, exactly. If you're thinking about alcohol that much, you're drinking too much. So for me, I tried so many things, Steve. Oh my God, like everything. I'll only drink Monday to Thursday. I'll only drink white wine, not red wine. It's red wine that's a problem. Oh no, it's wine. It's wine that's a problem. I'll just drink gin. I'll just drink cocktails. I'll just drink when I'm out. I'll just drink on a Thursday, or, you know, it was just total bullshit. I was trying to make drink fit into my life in any way that I could, because the thought of living without alcohol by that stage was absolutely abhorrent. And couldn't imagine my life without alcohol, because alcohol was what made me happy, and alcohol was what calmed me down, and alcohol helped me get to sleep, and alcohol helped, you know, it was ridiculous. And I just realized that my brain was like at war with itself, because I knew I had to stop, but I couldn't imagine a world where I could stop. And I think at that stage I started to investigate why I was doing it, like, what, because I couldn't understand, like, what the fuck am I getting out of this now? I would drink two, three bottles of wine on bad occasions, and I'd be opening the third. I couldn't even remember drinking the second, and there was no buzz. There was no high anymore, and I'd just be like, why? What is happening in my body, in my brain, that is making me do this? You know, and that's when I started sort of trying to research was happening, like what was alcohol doing to me that made me drink it even when the buzz had already gone. And I started investigating. I started off reading a book called Alcohol Explained by William Porter, and that's just kind of a scientific explanation of alcohol and how it works. And then I got a book, and it was so weird. I was buying these books and reading these books, and I kind of hide them. It was weird process. But I was ingesting them, like, slowly but surely. And the next one I read was This Naked Mind by Annie Grace. And there was one basic sum that was just a really, I hope I can explain this well, but it's a real simple sum that she explained, which is about why alcohol is a stimulant and a depressant at the same time, which is that when you drink alcohol, like you have one glass of wine, it releases this artificial dopamine hit in your brain, and it's like, yay, this is great. And that basically lasts for 20 minutes, and then your brain immediately counteracts that with a downer. So basically you've got 20 minute high, and then the downer, which your brain releases, can't remember what that's called, dianorphine or something like that, and that's a 2-hour process. So for every drink you drink, you've got a 20 minute high, 2-hour low, 20 minute high, 2-hour low. And that basic kind of sum just really resonated with me, and I was like, Jesus Christ, that's why I always need another drink, because a downer kicks in. That's why I can't moderate. That's why I can't, you know, as soon as I've had one drink, that process will just kick off again. It's never, you can't outrun it. That's just the science. It's always going to happen. And for whatever reason, that really, really hit home with me, that simple equation. I just had it in my head, like, you're going to drink that drink, you're going to have 20 minute high, 2-hour low. And the kicker is, for every drink you get, you've got a 2-hour low. So that's why I'd be getting like 3-day hangovers, because that's how many drinks I was drinking in like one binge session. So I guess that is how my sobriety journey began. And the more I read and the more I read around it, the more it became clear to me that I did lots of runs at sobriety. So I said, right, I'm going to do a 30-day challenge. And I did it. You know, I couldn't believe I did it. I did 30 days without drinking. But as soon as I went back onto the drink, as planned, it was just as bad as ever. You know, there was no... And in it, there was a year, I had a year of my life where I tried literally everything. 30 days on, 30 days off, 50 days off, 30 days on. And I did these sprints at sobriety, which... Never once did I say, that's it, I'm never drinking again, up until this time. But for me, I guess we all have our own paths, but for me, it just took me that long to really actually believe it in my soul that alcohol had absolutely no part in my life. On one of my stints back on alcohol, I became so... I had a a sort of a depression, which hit me so hard and so fast. And because I'd had a 30 stint sobriety period sort of prior to that, it was so powerful because I was able to say, I didn't have this problem when I wasn't drinking. And it just suddenly became like really clear that Jesus Christ, alcohol is so interconnected with, I mean, God knows why it took me so long to realize, but to your mental health, to your physical health, obviously, but to every kind of aspect of your body, if you're just, my God, absolutely. And but honestly, Steve, it took me such a long time to work that out. And I feel like I had to go into that depression and I feel like I had to run through those stints at sobriety before I could be where I am. Like I guess that was my rock bottom, really. It wasn't like a public rock bottom, but it was definitely an internal rock bottom, you know. It couldn't have got any lower. And that was the moment, I think, when, armed with all of this knowledge that I'd ingested through lots of books, another one was The Unexpected Joy of Being Sober by Catherine Groach, had a huge impact on me because her life was quite similar to mine. Like, she worked in London, she worked around alcohol. And armed with all of that kind of knowledge, I thought, fuck this, I'm never going to drink again. And I think that big decision, like, when you just literally say to yourself, I am never ever going to question this decision, that's it. And I think at that moment I just felt just so, like, so liberated, because you spend so much of your brain power and space and time and energy thinking about alcohol, worrying about alcohol. When am I going to drink? What did I do? What did I say? When will I drink next? When will I... all of that chatter just... Oh my God. Oh my God. Yeah. And to just shut down all of that chatter at once and be like, and that's it. And now I'm never going to drink again. Just felt great. And it just felt like this. But obviously, I'm still like my early days of sobriety. I'm, you know, just past 4 months sober. Thank you. Thank you. I mean, I know I'm still an absolute, like, it is, and I know I'm still like a real, you know, baby goo-goo in the sobriety world. It's nothing, I know, but I feel so different in my heart because it's not a struggle. Like, I feel like really I did that year of, I'll just do 30 days, I'll just moderate, I'll just, a full-time kind of research and investigation, and that year really was all of my kind of huge preparation for the rest of my life, really. And since making that decision and never questioning it, and then also reaching out, because, you know, I never did meetings, and since now it's something I might do latterly, but I've met a lot of people who do that on you know, in sober mm-hmm. Instagram world, which is a great community, isn't it?
We're happy to have them, more the better.
Steve. Yeah, but what I really like about it, I just feel in the world that I've connected with on Instagram, is that everyone's got their own story, and lots of people have got a different route to sobriety. There's no wrong way of doing it. But it's such a supportive and just a really, I'm struggling to find the word actually, because it means so much to me, like the community on Instagram, and it's my accountability. Like, I try and post every day. There's a lot of people who you really get to know, you know, and it's just it's a really positive side of sobriety. And I think that's,
we all know
what
it's
I needed.
What's at stake. And we all have been at our lowest, and we know what it takes to come out of that. So we automatically, like a magnet, someone says something bad, someone posts something that you want to hear, someone celebrates an anniversary, it's like, congrats, like, you know, like, send messages, how you doing, you know, it's like piranhas to blood. That's how it works, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's a really special place. And, you know, I think it's kind of like, funnily enough, I never did Instagram, neither personally or in any way, before setting up my mm-hmm. sobriety account. So I had no sort of social media presence before this. And it's such a beautiful kind of little world to me, because it's exactly the opposite of what I imagined Instagram to be like, where everyone, I always thought Instagram's a place where everyone pretends to be perfect and everyone's looking fabulous and everyone's life is great. And it's the exact opposite in the sober community, because everyone's sort of just completely raw and honest and supportive and, you know, cohesive. And it just feels like a really safe place to be and to be sober and to sort of tell our sober stories.
We can all, and a lot of us, like, branch off. And, you know, like with me, I started this podcast just by accident because I was asked to do one. And I said, well, how hard could it be? And I looked and I started it. And before you know it, you know, it started as, what started as like a hobby became something that was bigger than me, in that I can get people on to share their experience, strength, and hope. I get something out of it. The person telling the story gets something out of it. And I get feedback from people that say it's incredible, the people you have on. And I'm just like a middleman. You know, it's just, I'm lucky that
wow,
this avenue of social media. And I have someone that's going to do the show from Australia. And it's great because we can now reach across the other side of the world, you know. You go on these meetings, and I'm on with people from New Zealand, from Scotland, you know, from Ireland, UK, you know, people from Sweden. Like, we're making the world so small for such a big thing, you know. It's like a monumental process that we all go through, and we think that it's well, for me, I think it's like otherworldly. Sobriety is way beyond my grasp. And then what Instagram and social media did was say, no, it's not. We're going to take the world. We're going to compact it into handheld size that you can reach out and they can reach out to you, and you can just grow that much stronger. And I think it's a wonderful place.
Absolutely. And can I just say, Steve, I have been listening to your back catalogue of your podcast, and I absolutely love it. And I just think you have created this really safe space. And I was listening to Sarah, Connie, and Nick's stories, and you know, I just feel I feel very privileged to have been asked, because I know I'm in good company.
It's not, the privilege is all on this side, believe me. I reach out to people, I ask them to come on the show, and they love doing the show because it helps you to hear your own story, and you know you're going to help someone else. And I am just sitting here with the big shit-eating grin on my face the whole time, because I know that it helps, because I get so much help from listening to you, because I don't have to sit in my head. You know, I'm listening to someone else's story, which, by the way, is incredible.
Oh, thank you.
And I know you from seeing you out and posting videos of just you in nature. I'm like, I have so much in common with this woman. And it's amazing how people really attach themselves to nature when they get sober. You know, it's like, wow.
Absolutely.
It's like they just came out of the womb and just saw life for the first time. It really is like eye-opening.
Oh my gosh. It is exactly like that. It really is. That's a really good way of describing it, actually, because it's kind of funny for me, because sobriety and quarantine have coincided. So for me, it's kind of, I honestly sat in the garden the other day thinking, are the birds singing louder? They can't have always been singing this loud, and I just didn't hear it. And I'm so obsessed at the moment with just, I like running. It's kind of my escape. But obviously my one allowed exercise a day in the UK, that's what we're allowed. And I'll just run and then just sit in a field or a forest and just listen to the sounds of the birds. And spring is just such a lovely time. The bluebells are out and the daffodils are out. And it's like this whole canvas that I never saw the world like this when I was drinking. I just didn't. I didn't ever stop to, like, literally smell the flowers or listen to the birds, or because, you know, you're either hungover or you're drunk or you were thinking about your next drink. But you just, that mindfulness that comes with sobriety completely naturally is such a gift. And I think these are the things that I'm experiencing now. I know they talk about the pink cloud moments. I've definitely had that, you know, that kind of feeling of just sober euphoria. But nature is just, you know, it's such a gift, and it's just all around. And especially now, I think, because obviously there's so much less noise pollution, there's less traffic, It's just lovely. It's just a really lovely thing to see.
When I go outside into the world, not, you know, in the city or around people, but out in nature in the mountains and skiing and whatnot and hiking, and it's like I walk out into something that is seems to go on forever, which it does. And here's me, little Steve, out in this big, beautiful world, and all you get back is nonstop positivity from everything around you, from the animals, from the trees, even just the landscape is just beautiful. You get, the world offers us an abundance, a plethora of positive vibes coming towards us. And I tend to, when I was in my alcohol and drug addiction days, I would just hide from those feelings, you know? And it's like, why? Just be open and just absorb them all and be happy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Do you know, I was thinking that exact thought the other day, and I used to find nature a real inconvenience when I was drinking. Like, the sun would make my eyes squint, it would ruin my makeup, the rain would make my hair go frizzy. That's how I saw it. That is how, I'm not walking through a field in stilettos, are you kidding me? And it's just such a horrible way to live. Whereas now, it was pouring with rain here the other day for the first time in like weeks, and I was so excited. I was like a kid. I had this big umbrella and I was like, wow, you know, like a clear umbrella where you can kind of see up to the sky. And I was just kind of mesmerized by the raindrops, and it is, it's like seeing the world again through different eyes, because you just never took it in before. And there's so many gifts, I think, that come with sobriety, but I totally agree with you. I think nature is probably the biggest.
It's the endless supply of positive energy. And
totally.
I have the pleasure of working outside, you know, all year round. So sometimes when I want to take a break, like on a Sunday, I'll just stay inside. I'll keep the sliding glass door open, but I'll just sit on my couch next to it and like just relax, because I'm always out there, you know, and not that it's not that it's ever too much. But sometimes I like to just sit down on my couch and you know, watch a couple games if there's some sports on TV. But overall, at least 6 days a week, I am outside nonstop, you know. And that's why I love,
so nice.
I love like skiing, because the wintertime is rough for people, especially like I used to be with like almost like a seasonal depression. Which I found out because of alcohol and drugs, it became like a 24/7, 365 depression. Yeah. So I got myself mentally straight, and I realized when I stopped drinking, that in the wintertime, I used to ski when I was younger, and I don't have to sit inside and just be miserable. I can get out and do stuff, you know? And it's amazing how I took right back to it, you know? And I've been doing it ever since that first winter I got sober. I started getting back.
Good for you.
There's nothing like standing on top of a mountain, and it could be like, you know, 0 degrees out or even below zero. And as long as you're warm enough, you have enough layers on, you don't notice it, because you notice the beauty of what you're into. You know, you notice it's just... there could be tons of people around you, but all you zone them out, you know, because it's just you and the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start your descent and you just pick your line. And these lines are all made by nature. These are all formed, not by man, but by nature. You just go, the contours of the land of earth that you're just riding on two sticks or a snowboard or whatever on snow that hopefully naturally fell. You know, there's other ways to make it, but. You can't be more in touch with nature.
Yeah. Wow, that sounds amazing. And do you know, that's what we're meant to, that's where we're meant to be, isn't it? We spend so much time in offices and houses. And I do think that it's such a free, natural tonic if you can just get out wherever you are, just being outside, whatever the weather. Totally. Yeah, totally. And when I think of like the days that I just wasted, like, just cowering under a sheet with a hangover, or just, you know, floating around the house, just desperate, just wasted years, really. But you can't think like that. You've just got to keep looking forward and, you know, looking ahead. But yeah, it just feels great, Steve. And I would never want to go back to that life. It just feels, it does feel like being reborn, not to get too like biblical about it, but that's really what it's like.
Reach out. Don't be afraid to reach out. Yeah. I'm always here. And there's so many people online on Instagram. We may not answer the message right away or answer the phone right away, you know, because we might be sleeping.
Sure.
The thing is, you take that step to ensure that you stay healthy by reaching out to someone.
Yeah.
And that's so, you know, really subconsciously, that makes a difference. I mean, when you recognize an issue and you reach out to someone for help, even if they don't answer the phone, you already helped yourself because you took the initiative of reaching out to someone for the sole purpose of helping yourself. And that's what it's all about. And
sure.
I'm more than pleased to you know, do that. And that's why I put this podcast up, because, hey, you can always just dip in. And one of the people that I've interviewed, I'm sure everyone has something they can relate to one of you guys, you know, and that's why you do it, because it's great. So much fun. This is so much fun. It helps me tremendously, you know.
Oh, it's helped me tremendously as well. It's not very often that you think about your own life story, but it's been great. Yeah. And I really loved listening to other people's stories on your podcast as well. It just, it makes us feel connected, which I think is just one of the most important things, isn't it?
I'm going to put this episode up. I'm sure I'm going to get a lot of replies, and I'll see you on the gram, like I always say. And thank you so much for coming on our show. You're such a wonderful human being and an inspiration. And I hope a lot of people, you know, get at least a little something out of this episode. I know I do every time I see you.
Oh, thank you so much, Steve. It's a real privilege to be asked. So thank you. I've really, really enjoyed it.
Enjoy the rest of your day, and I'll be seeing you around.
You too.